KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Sunnyvale, South Bay.
I live in Oakland, California.
Concord. Parkside.
San Mateo.
Coming up, San Jose residents speak out against a proposal to build tiny homes for the homeless.
When my husband and I put our life savings into a house in San Jose in 1997, I never thought I'd be here asking you not to put homeless pods in my residential neighborhood.
Then we'll continue exploring the roots of agribusiness as our reporter travels abroad to Punjab, India.
I tell him it says you should be fully protected when handling the weed killer. He laughs. They say a lot of stuff. They even want us to wear gloves. I tell him maybe you should. It's fine, he replies. We don't have time for that.
Cross Currents is next. A year ago, many homeless advocates in San Jose got excited when the city approved plans to build the Bay Area's first tiny home villages for homeless people. But now that the city has to pick the locations for these proposed villages, objections from nearby residents have become a major stumbling block. KALW's housing and homelessness reporter Liza Veal joins me now. So Liza, what's the backstory here?
So in October of 2016, San Jose declared what's called a shelter crisis, and that allowed them to get the special permission to suspend the state building codes and to build these villages of tiny homes legally. The city has about 4,000 homeless people, and so this innovative approach was seen as a game changer in the state.
Okay, so can you describe exactly what the vision is for these villages?
Each village would have about 25 people. They'd be living in these micro homes, basically just big enough for a bed or a double bed for couples and a little bit of storage. They'd probably be solar powered, and then the bathrooms and maybe kitchen facilities would be shared outside of the homes. Some version of this has been done in a bunch of cities, in Detroit, in Seattle, in Austin. But even though the Bay Area has some of the highest rates of homelessness, it's never happened here, at least not legally.
Will it ever? What's the status of the San Jose proposal?
So the original vision was for each district in the city to develop a pilot project. Council members representing each of the districts were supposed to identify some options for locations, but many of the council members got pushback from their constituents when they started talking about different options. I have a recording from a town hall meeting where the District 2 council member, Sergio Jimenez, he's taking a vote on a possible site, and you can barely hear the yes votes. It's just a couple of people like raising their hands. There's not much noise. But then he says, and how many people say no? People said some really nasty anti-homeless things. I mean, everything you can imagine. At one point, people in the crowd started spontaneously chanting, build a wall.
So at the city council meeting last week, they were supposed to pick locations. What happened instead?
So most council members failed to come up with location options. And the hall was packed with people who'd come to oppose having these villages in their neighborhood. The tone was a lot more polite and formal than at the town hall meeting that I was telling you about. And the council members kept thanking everybody for being so civil. So here's some clips.
When my husband and I put our life savings into a house in San Jose in 1997, I never thought I'd be here asking you not to put homeless pods in my residential neighborhood or my park.
I think it's a ridiculous proposal. I don't think that there's any sociological basis for it, and these people will not be helped. They will be ostracized from the community because this is a single-family community. It is an aspirational neighborhood. It is a neighborhood that I moved into after living in downtown with homeless people for a number of years.
So in the end, city staff was just instructed to go back and come up with another list over the next 2 months. And this time, they're not supposed to just limit it to land that the city already owns. One city staffer that I talked to, he told me, we went with the land that the city already owns because it's low-hanging fruit. We can just start getting built. We can just start building. But now they think that the only land that they'll be able to get residents on board with is commercial industrial space away from residential neighborhoods, none of which the city already owns. So now buying or leasing that land is going to just take a lot longer. It's going to be a whole other set of negotiations, and it will probably cost a lot more.
So what's next then? Is it just take two on the search for locations?
Yeah, and then also they've set their expectations a lot lower. Instead of 10 pilot villages, one in each district, they're just aiming for 3 now.
Okay.
In cities all across the country, there are versions of this idea that are already happening. I mean, some are, you know, more official and successful, and some are just kind of under the radar. The city turns a blind eye. But I'm sure that right now in the Bay Area, city officials in, you know, other cities in San Francisco and in Oakland, they're watching what's happening in San Jose.
Okay, thanks, Liza.
Thanks.
Liza Veal is KALW's housing reporter. If you've got a housing story you'd like to share, email her at housing@kalw.org. This week, we're looking at how agriculture became agribusiness and how that's changing farming in California and in India. Yesterday, we met Sandeep Singh, an almond farmer from Modesto who moved to California from the state of Punjab in northern India. Sandeep's father still farms in Punjab, but he can barely make ends meet.
He says, we can hardly make enough money to survive by farming. After the harvest is over, when we're balancing our accounts, we find that we barely have enough left to eat. We aren't able to save money for anything else.
Today, small farmers in Punjab are dealing with the legacy of what's come to be known as the Green Revolution. It started in the 1960s, and it was about increasing food production, high-yielding seeds, pesticides, big machinery. The Green Revolution didn't just change how farmers farm, it changed how they live. KALW's Kavalroop Kaur Singh investigates.
A farm worker squats barefoot on the ground, his toes blackened by soil. He pours weed killer into a plastic bottle and walks over to a flooded field of rice. He bends over and fills the bottle with water. The mixture inside the bottle turns from yellow to a gleaming frothy white. He steps into the rice fields, the water splashes beneath his feet, and the weed killer sprays like a fountain from his hands. I'm standing on my ancestral farmland in a village called Rasulpur in the state of Punjab in northern India. The land belonged to my great-grandfather first, but today no one in my immediate family farms on it. Most of my family lives outside of India. The land is leased to a farmer with no relation to us whose name is Ravinder Singh. The farm worker who sprayed the weed killer while barefoot works for Ravinder. I pick up the weed killer carton to read the label. It's written in English. Ravinder asks me what it says. I tell him it says you should be fully protected when handling the weed killer. He laughs. They say a lot of stuff. They even want us to wear gloves. I tell him maybe you should. It's fine, he replies. We don't have time for that. Ravinder thinks that he and his workers have become immune to the effect of the chemical sprays because they use them so often. He says that his crops need chemicals to grow. He admits they can cause health problems, but they make a tough job a little easier. Farming is the most difficult, he says. You can't rest day or night. It's the hardest work there is. Agriculture is the largest industry in Punjab. 60% of the state's workforce is made up of farmers living in rural villages. The majority are subsistence farmers or family farmers who own less than 10 acres of land. The state of Punjab has a population comparable to the state of New York that lives on half as much land. Ravinder Singh says his children won't be farmers. One of his daughters has already moved to Canada on a student visa. He says there's very little profit in farming these days. The average annual income in Punjab is about 65,000 rupees, which is about $1,000 per year. I ask him if he's ever thought of selling his land. If I sell it, then what else will I do? He asks. We have no other work. Farming is the only means of survival we have. Ravinder says production costs have risen and that he's in debt. In fact, a study conducted by the Punjab Agricultural University found that 9 out of 10 farmers are in debt. The average amount owed is about 6 times the average annual income. So how did Punjab, the land of the five rivers, come to drown in debt? Sukhwinder Puppi is a member of the Association for Democratic Rights, an NGO that has worked closely with farmers in Punjab. He says, to understand debt, you have to go back to the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution brought a banking system with it, he says. Before, when people farmed naturally, they would grow a little cotton, corn, or sugarcane. They wouldn't need much money. It was a natural model of agriculture, but the Green Revolution destroyed the natural model and replaced it with a capitalist one. As farmers produced more crops, they had to buy new technologies. That meant heavier and heavier loans. Sukhwinder says agriculture in Punjab got so tangled up in the banking system that today all of Punjab's debt-ridden farmers are its casualty. But the consequences are far worse than debt. The Punjab Agricultural University estimates that at least 7,000 farmers have committed suicide in the past 15 years. Sukhwinder says the actual total could be triple that. He says that farmers' suicides are reported every day in the newspapers. One day, I opened up a local paper to see that two farmers had committed suicide on that very day in the same district I was reporting in. Karamjeet Kaur is an activist with a farmers organization called Bharati Kisan Union, or BKU. She lists the names of the dead farmers from her village.
Gurvinder Singh, Sanap Daleep Singh, Dayal Singh Mestri, Unnada Pitasi Kaka Singh, Te Gurpreet Singh.
Karamjeet says that a train runs through her village. In the past few years, she knows at least 5 farmers who have stepped in front of it to commit suicide. They leave behind families, children, elderly mothers, she says. The lives of their families are filled with suffering. It's unbearable. Karamjeet and I go to a village called Begelere, near a city called Bathinda in rural Punjab. We enter a temple where a group of villagers surround me. Their despair is palpable. One of them is a 45-year-old widow named Kuldeep Kaur. She tells me her husband was a farmer who committed suicide because of debt. My daughter was married. We had little land, so we were in debt, she says. Then my father-in-law died, and my oldest son, he drank chemical spray 4 times. He was in 10th grade when he died. Kuldeep's body begins to shake as she sobs. The women around us start speaking all at once, encouraging her to stay strong. Kuldeep says there's a great burden on her family. They're still 500,000 rupees in debt, about $8,000. They had to sell their land. The Punjab government created a policy to provide compensation to families of farmers who had committed suicide. But Kuldeep says the government hasn't provided any for her family. When it rains, she says, the roof in our house starts to cave in. We have no means of repairing it. Baramjeet Kaur is an activist representing 28 villages in the women's wing of the Farmers Union, BKU. She says, the Green Revolution has turned the faces of our farmers yellow. It's put us on the path of suicide. But Dr. P.S. Rungi disagrees with that argument. He's a retired professor from the Punjab Agricultural University. He was a consultant to the Punjab State Farmers Commission for about 30 years. He says Punjabi farmers, Punjab scientists, and Punjab's government took the Green Revolution forward. We fixed the food deficit and made the country self-sufficient. Punjab's grain production tripled in the decade after the Green Revolution. Why, then, are so many farmers committing suicide in Punjab?
Agriculture karke nahi suicide hunde.
Suicides aren't happening because of agriculture, he says. It's complex. Suicide is in every section.
Do you think the students don't do it? Women nahi kardiyan suicide?
Women don't commit suicide, he asks. Is the rate of farmers' suicides more than the rest of society?
Not. It is at par.
But actually, it's not the same. The rate of suicide among Indian farmers is about 50% higher than the national average. The most common way to commit suicide in India is by ingesting pesticides, which suggests farming communities are the ones most affected by suicide. I ask, if agriculture is not the reason for farmer suicide, then what is? The farmers that commit suicide are small farmers who are uneducated, he says. Farming isn't the only reason they do it. A study from Punjab Agricultural University found that the primary reasons for farmers' suicide were poverty and debt. Research conducted by the Agriculture Commission found that 40% of the farmers of Punjab were willing to transition into other sectors, he says, and he thinks they should.
Sanu vocational training, skill training.
We need to provide appropriate vocational training and skills training for farmers, he says. As a country or state progresses, people must leave the agricultural sector and find other work. But the farmers' unions think this is just the government's way to get rid of small farmers. Harinder Kaur Bindu is the president of the women's wing of the local BKU in the cotton-growing Bathinda region of Punjab. They take land from small farmers, construct buildings on it, sell those buildings, and make huge profits, she says. The government wants big farms with big machines, like in California. That's what they dream about. Harinder says that farmers won't give up their land easily. She says, the land is our mother, it's our sustenance, it's worth our life. Harinder and three other women activists from BKU get out of a small car that has two giant megaphones affixed to the top. They've just been traveling from the sprawling city of Bathinda to the small village Begelere on its outskirts. They are here to talk with the villagers about upcoming actions to demand the government help pay back farmers' loans. Harinder is standing on the roof of the village Gurdwara, or Sikh temple, using the temple speakers to call all the farmers, farm workers, and their families to assemble. She has a history of leading successful demonstrations in this village. Several months ago, the state government acquired the land of a village farmer, Jaswant Singh, to build a market. But when Jaswant came to collect his compensation, he was refused by a government worker. After 3 months of pleading, Jaswant committed suicide in the government office and left a note accusing the worker. The BKU Farmers Union demanded the worker's arrest, but the police took no action. So the union organized the villagers and held protests and sit-ins for 8 days. On the 8th day, the police made the arrest. About 50 villagers gather around the temple in the evening light. They are mostly elderly men and women. The men hold green and yellow flags with the BKU logo. It's a white circle with a farmer and his oxen plowing a field at the center, the way farming in Punjab used to look before the Green Revolution. The villagers chant slogans, "Down with the government that keeps our youth unemployed, down with the debt our farmers owe. don't commit suicide, commit to the struggle. That's a rare message of hope at a time when temperatures rise, farming becomes tougher, and more farmers commit suicide. In Bathinda, Punjab, I'm Kamalroop Kaur Singh for Cross Currents.
That story was made possible in part by the International Center for Journalists. It's the second in a series of stories about Punjabi farmers. Go to our website, klw.org, and click Cross Currents to find out more. And tune in tomorrow for part three of our series on Punjabi farmers. We'll see how massive chemical companies impacted farming in India, leading to large-scale migration to California.
2 years ago, farmers in the cotton-growing belt were growing BT cotton. BT cotton is a pest-resistant, genetically modified seed produced by Monsanto, the U.S.-based multinational corporation. In 2015, after whiteflies devastated Punjab's BT cotton crop, a new pesticide called Oberon was marketed to farmers by another multinational corporation, Bayer. But farmers say the pesticide failed. Sukhjeet Kaur remembers. First, we had a lot of cotton, she says. We sprayed it with so many pesticides, and when it was supposed to be ripe for picking, it just dried up.
That's tomorrow, the third and final part of our series on Punjabi farmers. And that's all for today's show. The team includes Andy Bosselman, Raquel Maria Dillon, Asal Ehsanipour, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Zaina Nasser, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Stephen Short, Jackie Sajiko, Andrew Stelzer, and Laura Wenis. Our engineers are Gabe Graben and James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Oakland native Paris Escovedo. Paris Escovedo and the Music of Azteca have a show at the Phoenix in San Rafael on Friday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Apple.